This is Audible.
Soundings Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of A Child is Born, written by Donna Douglas, read by Penelope Freeman. The moral right of the author has been asserted. This performance is owned by Soundings, Whitley Bay, NE26, 2JT. Chapter 1. Christmas Eve, 1936, was the foggiest night anyone could remember. A deadening grey pall hung over the streets of Bethnal Green, dense, cold, and carrying a metallic tang from the factory chimneys. People inched through it, bumping into each other on the shrouded streets, their heads down, faces muffled in scarves, and coat collars to keep the damp air off their chests. No one wanted a bout of bronchitis for Christmas. A real pea-super, Sidney Allen thought to himself, as he nosed his trolley bus through the sparse evening traffic along Burdett Road towards Mile End, hunched over the wheel, peering into the gloom. Thank God it was his last run before he clocked off for Christmas. He was looking forward to getting home, that was for sure. His missus would have a good fire going, and the kettle on, and she'd be fussing around getting the house straight for Christmas. The kids would be excited too. Bless them, they'd hardly slept for a week. They'd set their heart on Father Christmas bringing them a bike, and Sidney had been worried he might not be able to afford it. But his mate on the bins had come up trumps with an old one someone had chucked out. Sidney had spent the last month putting it together and polishing it up in his mate's backyard, and now it was as good as new. He couldn't wait to see the kids' faces when they clapped eyes on it. Not long to go now, he thought, as he turned onto the Mile End Road. Some people had started their Christmas early, judging by the laughter and festive sing-song coming from behind him. The brightly lit interior of the trolley bus was full to bursting, standing room only, but no one seemed to mind. They were all just grateful to be warm and cosy and heading home. A few sounded the worse for wear as they joined in with the chorus of Silent Night.
Silent Night? I should be so lucky, the row you lot are making, the conductor complained.
But next minute he was joining in, getting into the Christmas spirit. Sidney grinned to himself and started humming under his breath. Not long now. Just a little way down the Mile End Road, then a right turn towards Stepney Green Station, and they'd all be home. Suddenly, his headlamps picked out a woman standing on the pavement waiting to cross the road, the fog swirling around her. She had her head down, her coat pulled tight. Afterwards he had no idea what made him do it. Perhaps it was 10 years of driving trolley buses in East London that had given him an instinct. But without thinking, he slammed on the brakes, just as the woman stepped off the curb straight into his path. He heard swearing and shouts of outrage behind him as the passengers tumbled around inside the trolley bus, but he barely noticed them as he sat shaking behind the wheel, his eyes shut tight in fear of what lay ahead of him. Chapter 2.
I hope it's quiet tonight.
Helen stood at the mirror fastening her collar stud ready for her night duty.
It's always awful when someone is rushed in on Christmas Eve, isn't it? You can't help thinking of their families and how they must be feeling.
She glanced at the reflection of her roommate, Jennifer Ryan. She sat cross-legged on the bed, studying her face in the mirror of her powder compact. Unlike Helen, Jennifer had finished her duty for the day and was getting ready to go out and celebrate Christmas with her friends. Helen gave up waiting for a reply and turned back to her reflection to adjust her starched collar. She had only recently moved into the nurse's home after passing her state finals, and she was still getting used to it. Not that staff nurse Ryan made it any easier for her. It wasn't that she was particularly unfriendly. She just seemed to act as if Helen didn't exist. She tried again.
I suppose it must be even sadder for you on Parry Ward, all those children away from their families at Christmas.
Jennifer shrugged.
Sister Parry does her best to make it special for them.
Helen waited for her to continue, but she went back to powdering her face. Helen sighed, and she thought she was the shy one. She decided to make one final stab at conversation.
Will you be working tomorrow, or are you one of the lucky ones going home to your family?
Jennifer scowled back at her over her mirror.
I'm working, thank God,
she murmured under her breath. So quietly, Helen wondered if she'd imagined it.
I suppose I'll be sleeping through most of it, if we're busy tonight.
Not that it bothered Helen too much. She would happily have given the whole of Christmas a miss if she could. This was her first Christmas without Charlie. She still missed him terribly, but she forced herself to look forward, not back, because she knew it was what he would have wanted. All the same, she knew this Christmas would be a test for her. She dearly wished she had her friends around her. Her old roommates, Millie and Dora, would have cheered her up. Helen missed their laughter, and the way they helped each other through so much heartache. She would have loved to go on sharing a room with them forever, but they were still students, and she was now a qualified staff nurse. She smiled, thinking about how excited they would be as Christmas approached, No doubt Millie would have decorated their chilly attic room with paper chains by now, in defiance of the home sister. She would have hidden presents for Dora and Helen under her bed, and it would be all they could do to stop her bursting and telling them what she'd bought. Darling Millie. She always said she preferred giving gifts to receiving them. Talking of giving, Helen suddenly remembered the post she'd picked up that morning.
I almost forgot. A card arrived for you.
She went to her drawer to fetch it. Jennifer looked up sharply.
For me? I picked it up with my letters this morning. Mr. Hopkins insisted I should take it. He said you hadn't picked up your post in a few days.
She handed it over. It felt thick, like a Christmas card. Perhaps it would cheer Jennifer up, she thought. Jennifer didn't take it at first. She just sat there on the bed, staring down at the cream envelope. Then finally, she snatched it from Helen's hand, glanced at the writing, ripped it up, and threw the pieces into the bin. Helen stared at her in astonishment.
What did you do that for? You didn't even see who it was from.
I already know. Jennifer's voice was flat. She clicked her compact shut and threw it in her bag, then gathered up her coat.
I'm going out, she said. Good night.
Good night, and happy Christmas,
Helen started to say, but the door slammed shut. Helen stared at the door. Then her gaze dropped to the fragments in the bin. Who could have sent Jennifer a card that put her in such a bad mood, she wondered. She shrugged. It was none of her business anyway, she told herself, as she pinned her cap in place, folding the starched fabric deftly, so that not an inch of her dark hair was showing. But all the time, she couldn't stop thinking about that torn-up card in the bin. She knew it was none of her business and that she shouldn't look, but all the same, before she knew it, she was on her knees in front of the bin, picking out the pieces of card and putting them together like a jigsaw on the polished linoleum floor. She thought it would be a Christmas card, but it wasn't. It was a birthday card covered in embossed roses. She dug around in the bin and found some more pieces, enough to put together the scrawled greeting inside, "To Jenny, from your loving father."
I forgot my scarf and I'm not going out in that fog with that. What are you doing?
Helen jumped guiltily at the sound of Jennifer's voice. Jennifer stood in the doorway, her bag in her hand, quivering with outrage. Helen jumped up.
I'm sorry, I was just looking. Snooping, you mean?
Jennifer swooped into the room. Pushing past her, she bent down and gathered up the pieces of card.
You had no right. No right at all.
I know, I'm sorry.
Helen saw the flush of angry colour in Jennifer's face and knew she'd made a terrible mistake.
I was just curious, that's all. Well, don't be.
Jennifer straightened up and threw the pieces of card back into the bin. She snatched up her scarf from the bed and headed for the door.
I didn't know it was your birthday,
Helen said. Jennifer paused briefly in the doorway.
It isn't,
she said.
But the card, it's a lie.
Before Helen could say any more, Jennifer added sharply,
Shouldn't you be reporting for duty? Miss Fian won't be pleased if you're late. Oh, Lord, you're right.
Helen jammed her feet into her stout black shoes and swung her thick navy blue cloak around her shoulders. By the time she was ready, Jennifer had gone. Helen hesitated, glancing at the bin. Far from making friends with her new roommate, she had a feeling she'd just made things a lot worse. Chapter 3. As soon as Helen arrived in theatre, she realized that her hopes for a quiet and eventful Christmas Eve were going to be dashed.
There's been a trolley bus accident on the Mile End Road.
Miss Fian, the theatre sister, greeted her as she took off her cloak.
Several passengers hurt, most with shock and minor injuries. They're being dealt with in casualty, but a woman was run down.
Oh, no!
Helen shuddered, despite the sweltering heat of the operating theatre.
How bad is she, sister?
She was very lucky. The driver saw her and managed to put the brakes on just in time. But she was pregnant, and she's gone into labour. Mr. Cooper is on his way down for an emergency caesarean. I need you to prep for him as soon as possible.
Yes, sister.
Helen changed out of her heavy calico dress and into her theatre uniform as quickly as she could, then set about preparing the tray of instruments that the consultant would need. She could only imagine Mr. Cooper's dismay at being summoned so late on Christmas Eve. She was surprised the senior consultant was on call, and not one of his registrars or housemen. Perhaps, like Helen, he thought he might get away with a quiet night. She finished preparing the instruments and had just covered them with a sterile cloth, when the patient arrived on a trolley, pushed by a porter and accompanied by Nurse Willard from casualty.
She's been shaved and we've washed out her stomach just in case,
she said. Helen looked down at the woman. She was short, stocky and dark-haired, with heavy, solid limbs and thick black brows that made her look as if she was frowning, even in repose. Her sallow skin had an ashen tinge and wide lips were pale and cracked.
How long has she been unconscious?
She asked.
Since she came in. Reckon she must have cracked her head when she went down in front of that trolley car.
Nurse Willard winced.
It's horrible when you think about it, isn't it?
It could have been a lot worse if that driver hadn't managed to stop in time.
I suppose you're right. She was lucky anyway. I don't suppose she saw it coming until it was nearly on top of her in this fog.
Hmm. Helen ignored her as she fetched a basin of clean hot water and soap, and briskly set about cleaning the woman's abdomen before the operation. Penny Willard had a reputation as a chatterbox, and she couldn't afford to waste any time. Mr. Cooper wouldn't be impressed if he arrived and found his patient unprepared, while Helen stood gossiping. Fortunately, Miss Fearn arrived and put a stop to it.
"Don't you have other patients to attend to, nurse?"
she asked.
"Dawson has work to do, even if you don't."
She shook her head as Nurse Willard slouched off.
"Look at her," she tutted. "I've seen snails move faster. You wouldn't think casualty was packed to the rafters with the walking wounded, would you? How's Sister Cass must despair of that girl?"
Helen rinsed off the soap, then purified the woman's abdomen with warm carbolic lotion. She had just applied a perchloride compress when the consultant, Mr. Cooper, swept in. Even in his surgical gown, a cap pulled over his black hair, he still looked like a matinee idol.
"Thank you, nurse."
His blue eyes twinkled at her over his surgical mask. Unlike other consultants, who tended to treat nurses as if they were no more than another piece of surgical equipment, he was always courteous to the people around him.
"Right. Let's get this baby delivered, shall we?"
In spite of his confidence, it was a difficult operation. Helen could feel the tension in the room as Mr. Cooper worked quickly, constantly checking with the anaesthetist that the woman's vital signs weren't dropping away. It was Helen's job to act as intermediary between the scrub nurse and the non-sterile area of the operating theatre, and she found herself crossing her fingers for the poor woman's safety as she watched the operation nervously from the other side of the theatre. It took Mr. Cooper less than 10 minutes to deliver the baby into the world. He emerged, blue-grey and furious, his tiny fists clenched, eyes squeezed shut, mouth wide open, screaming in protest.
"Well, at least we know there's nothing wrong with his lungs,"
Mr. Cooper beamed around at them.
"Well, ladies and gentlemen, it looks as if we might have delivered the Nightingale's first Christmas baby."
"Well, there's still 2 hours to go until Christmas Day,"
Dr. Little, the anaesthetist, reminded him.
"We could deliver another half dozen before then."
"Oh, good Lord, I hope not."
Mr. Cooper rolled his eyes.
"My wife will be furious if I'm not home before midnight. I've had to abandon a drinks party in Kensington for this as it is."
Chapter 4. Christmas morning brought a great deal of excitement on Parry, the children's ward. In the weeks leading up to Christmas, Sister Parry had been gathering together bits and pieces for the children, and had fashioned stockings out of tubular bandages, which Miss Tanner, the night sister, had hung at the foot of each child's bed during the night. There were exclamations of delight as the children woke up to their very own stockings stuffed with oranges, apples, treacle toffees, pencils, marbles, and other marvels. Meanwhile, the nurses on Parry had a Christmas gift of their own to ooh and ah over.
"Isn't he beautiful?"
one of the students, Katie O'Hara, sighed, rocking the new baby softly in her arms.
"Such a little dot. We should call him Gabriel, because he looks like a little angel. Don't let Sister hear you,"
Jennifer Ryan warned. "You know what she's like about getting too attached to the children.
But she can't mind us giving the little chap a name."
Katie O'Hara planted a kiss on the baby's downy brow.
"We've got to call him something." "No, but she'll mind if she catches you cuddling him again," said Jennifer. "Put him back in his cot before he sees you, for heaven's sake. Is there any news of his mother?"
another of the students asked. Jennifer shook her head.
"She still hasn't recovered consciousness."
They stood around the cot, each silent, as they considered how grave the situation was.
"Well, just think how happy she'll be when she wakes up and finds out she has a baby son,"
Katie said brightly. "If she wakes up." Someone else spoke the words they were all thinking. Katie bent down and fussed with the baby's blanket, tucking it in around him.
"Imagine having your birthday on Christmas Eve,"
she mused, changing the subject.
"You'll get twice the presents."
"Or miss out completely," one of the students said grimly. "My brother's birthday's on Boxing Day, and he's forever complaining people only give him one present."
"He's lucky he gets anything at all with that attitude,"
Katie replied.
"When you've stopped gossiping, perhaps you can all get on with your work."
Jennifer cut them off sharply.
"I know it's Christmas, but there are still dressings to be changed and beds to be made."
"Hark at her,"
she heard Katie O'Hara complaining as she walked away.
"Someone's full of the festive spirit."
They busied themselves for a couple of hours. Then at 10 o'clock, Sister Parry summoned them all into her office for a cup of coffee and a nip of brandy. She distributed small gifts of soap and talcum powder to each of the nurses, and they, in turn, gave her the cigarette case they'd clubbed together to buy for her. Shortly afterwards, Mr. Hopkins, the head porter, arrived on the ward, dressed as Father Christmas, with yet more gifts for the children, generously donated by the Board of Trustees.
"Look at them," Sister Parry whispered to Jennifer as they watched them excitedly tearing off wrapping paper and pulling at string. "Odd, isn't it, that this might be the best Christmas some of the poor little beggars have ever had?"
"Yes, Sister,"
Jennifer smiled. The brandy had made Sister Parry uncharacteristically sentimental. Once it wore off, she would be stalking down the ward, demanding that they clear up the mess. Jennifer was off duty from 1 until 5, so she left the students trying to quieten down the thoroughly overexcited children in time for their Christmas dinner, and headed off to the dining hall. There was a festive mood here, too, as the assembled nurses, some of them wearing paper hats over their caps, watched Mr. Cooper applying his surgical skills to a turkey. Matron and some of the Board of Trustees were with them, taking pride of place at the sisters' table, so the merriment was more subdued than it might have been. Afterwards, she was heading back to the nurses' home to put her feet up, when she spotted a familiar blue Wolseley parked outside. She stopped in her tracks and started to retreat back towards the main hospital building. But the driver had already seen her and was getting out of the car.
"Jenny?"
She stopped, hearing the crunch of her father's approaching footsteps on the gravel drive. She couldn't bring herself to look at him.
"What are you doing here?"
"Can't I come and visit you on your birthday?"
He sounded jovial. Jennifer's hands balled into fists at her sides.
"It's not my birthday," she said in a low voice.
"It's what your mother and I always considered to be your birthday. The day you came to us. The day our lives together began."
"Yes, but it's not my real birthday, is it? Just like you're not my real parents."
"Jenny!"
She sensed him flinch.
"How can you say that?"
"It's the truth."
She allowed herself to look at him. He had aged in the years since her mother, or the woman who called herself her mother, had died. He was no longer the tall, strong man she remembered as a child. He was stooped, his face thinner. Jennifer had to steel herself not to reach out to him.
"He lied to you," she reminded herself. "For 25 years he's lied to you about everything. Your name, where you came from, even your birthday's not real."
"I'm your father," he said wearily. "I know it was a shock for you finding out the way you did."
"A shock?"
A laugh escaped her.
"You mean being told at your mother's funeral by a relative you hardly know that you're adopted?"
Geoffrey Ryan took off his hat and ran his hand over his balding head. He'd lost more hair in the last year, too. The wintry sunshine gleamed on his pale scalp.
"It was wrong of us," he sighed. "We meant to tell you, we truly did. But we thought it would be best to wait until you were older. And then as time went on, it became harder and harder to find the right time."
He looked up at her, his eyes full of appeal.
"We were so afraid that when you found out, you would turn against us."
"And so it was easier to go on lying to me,"
Jennifer lashed out.
"You were so selfish, so concerned with what you wanted. You didn't think for a moment about me."
"That's not true. We thought about you all the time. You were the center of our world, right from the moment we first held you in our arms."
His voice trembled with emotion.
"All right. Perhaps your mother didn't give birth to you. But you were our baby in every other sense of the word. We couldn't have cared for you or loved you more if you had been our flesh and blood."
"But I'm not,"
Jennifer said coldly. Her father sighed.
"Jenny, I wish you could find it in your heart to forgive us. To forgive me,"
he amended in a choked voice.
"It's not fair that you're treating me like this. We need each other, especially now your mother's gone."
"You lied to me,"
Jennifer repeated.
"My whole life has turned out to be a lie, and I can't forgive you for that. I don't think I'll ever forgive you."
"Jenny!"
"Leave me alone, will you? Just leave me alone."
She moved to step past him, but he held on to her arm.
"Before you go, I want to give you this."
He opened the car, reached into the back seat and pulled out a parcel wrapped up in flowery wrapping paper and topped off with a flamboyant silky bow. Jennifer regarded it warily.
"What is it?"
"Call it a birthday present."
"I don't want it."
"Jenny, please."
"I told you I don't want it. I don't want anything from you, except to be left alone."
She shrugged him off and stomped off back towards the nurse's home, slamming the door behind her. She stood at the door, watching him through the leaded panes of coloured glass, the way his shoulders slumped in defeat, the parcel still in his hands, nearly broke her heart. And when he brought his hand up to his eyes to rub away his tears, She had to turn away to stop herself crying too. She knew she was being harsh, but she was so hurt and angry she couldn't help herself. A year ago, her idyllic life had been turned upside down, and she'd found out the people she loved and trusted most in the whole world had lied to her. Now, in the course of 12 months, she had become wary, suspicious, and unable to trust anyone. How was she supposed to forgive something like that? Chapter 5.
What are you doing here? You do realize the other staff nurses will give you hell if they find out you've been slamming it with us humble students.
Helen laughed off her friend Dora's teasing.
Fine. If you don't want your Christmas presents, I'll just go and give them to someone who'll appreciate them. Oh, no, if there's presents, then I suppose we can let you off. What do you reckon, Benedict?
Dora winked at Millie.
As long as she doesn't go straight off and report us to Matron for daring to speak to her.
Millie agreed. It felt odd to be back in the attic room. The chill wind still whistled through the ill-fitting skylight window, and the floorboard still showed through a balding patch in the faded rug, but it was comforting to be back, and she settled cross-legged on her old bed in the corner, although the lumpy old mattress was bare on the iron bedstead.
You still haven't been given a new roommate, then? She said. No, thank God,
Dora said with feeling, reaching up to open the skylight so she could light a cigarette. The home sister disapproved of smoking, and had once thrown a bucket of cold water over a student she'd caught lighting up in her room.
We're hoping Sister Sutton won't remember we have a spare bed up here,
Millie said.
It wouldn't be the same sharing with anyone but you.
I know what you mean,
Helen replied gloomily.
My new roommate isn't a bit like you.
You mean she doesn't leave her things lying all over the place like Benedict?
Dora grinned, then dodged as Millie aimed a pillow at her.
What's she like?
Millie asked.
Bit odd, actually.
Helen thought for a moment, trying to find the words to describe Jennifer.
Not unfriendly, exactly. Just very quiet. Sounds like bliss,
Dora said, glancing at Millie. Dora and Millie smoked their cigarettes as they talked about their Christmas on the wards. Dora was the luckiest. She was working on male orthopedics, which always tended to be a lark. The patients were mostly young men with sports injuries, very lively and always up for a laugh. The ward was also run by Sister Blake, who, unlike many of the other ward sisters, was known for a sense of humour and kindness to her nurses.
But we've still been busy, Dora said. We had a few emergency admissions last night. Passengers who were injured when their trolley bus hit that woman. There were a couple of broken bones and a dislocated hip. Very nasty. Not as bad as that poor woman who ended up in front of it,
Millie shuddered.
She still hasn't recovered consciousness yet. The consultant reckons she must have sustained a nasty head injury.
Does anyone know who she is yet? Helen asked.
Millie shook her head.
She had no bag or purse on her. No one has any idea who she is. It's almost as if she didn't want to be found,
Dora remarked. Millie frowned.
Why wouldn't she want to be found? Well, that bus driver said she walked straight out in front of him, didn't he? Perhaps she wanted to kill herself. Surely not.
Millie looked genuinely shocked.
Not in her condition.
Dora and Helen exchanged glances. Millie was endearingly naive sometimes, Helen thought.
All the more reason, I'd say, Dora said. She won't be the first pregnant woman to try to do something daft. Look at all those poor girls who end up in gynae, half butchered by backstreet abortionists, just so they can avoid the shame of having a baby out of wedlock.
Yes, but this baby wasn't born out of wedlock. The woman's got a ring on her finger.
Well, that means nothing,
Dora said knowingly.
What about that cheap ring Seb bought so you could sneak off to a guest house in Brighton?
Millie blushed.
Well, that's different. And besides, this woman looks married.
Helen laughed.
How do you mean?
Well, I don't know. She just does. I'm certain she's a husband somewhere. So why hasn't he come looking for her?
Dora asked. Millie shrugged.
I wish I knew,
she sighed. Chapter 6. On Boxing Day, much to everyone's relief, the woman finally regained consciousness. Millie was doing TPRs when the woman's eyes flicked open.
Where am I?
She looked around wildly, then caught sight of Millie in her uniform and her face filled with terror.
Who are you? What's happening to me?
Shh! It's all right. You're in hospital, but you're quite safe.
Millie put her hands on her shoulders, gently easing her back against the pillows.
Don't try to move just yet. I'll fetch Sister.
Sister Judd was a small, shy woman who rarely spoke above a whisper. But this time her gentle, soothing voice was just what was needed to calm the agitated woman.
You were in a nasty accident, she explained. You've been asleep for 2 days.
The woman stared up at her blankly.
I don't know. I don't remember anything,
she murmured. She spoke with an East End accent, but there was a foreign edge to her voice. Russian or some other Eastern European language, Millie guessed. That would match with her dark colouring and heavy features.
"Can you tell me your name?" Sister Judd asked.
The woman's face filled with panic.
I don't know.
She grabbed Sister Judd's sleeve.
I told you, I don't remember anything. Oh, God, I don't even know my own name.
She burst into noisy tears.
Shh, don't worry about it. I'm sure it'll all come back to you in a day or so, Sister Judd soothed. In the meantime, just try to rest. I'll send for the consultant and then we'll try to find you something to eat. I dare say you're hungry, aren't you?
The consultant was summoned. He duly examined her and declared that she seemed to be recovering well. Millie was then instructed to prepare some Benga's food for her.
I'm surprised she hasn't asked about her baby,
another student, Lucy Lane, commented as she joined Millie in the hospital kitchen.
She probably doesn't remember anything about it,
Millie said. Lucy Lane snorted with derision.
How can anyone forget they're pregnant, for heaven's sake? The poor woman can't even remember her own name,
Millie reminded her. Lucy folded her arms.
Well, I think someone should tell her,
she declared.
I expect Sister Judd will break it to her gently when she thinks the time's right,
Millie said primly, stirring the contents of the beaker.
Do you think I've left this long enough?
She asked.
Sister said at least 20 minutes, but I think it...
Before she could finish her sentence, a loud cry almost made her drop the beaker she was holding. It was followed closely by the most unearthly wailing sound. Lucy gave a twisted smile.
If you ask me, Sister's just broken the news to her,
she said. Chapter 7. Little Gabriel was 3 days old, and the nurses were still fighting over who would have the pleasure of giving him his feeds. As staff nurse, Jennifer usually managed to pull rank over the students, but that didn't stop them wandering in from the milk kitchen to sneak a peep at him as he suckled contentedly on his bottle.
Look at him. He's such a sweetheart,
Katie O'Hara sighed.
I wonder why his mother hasn't been down to see him yet. She still doesn't accept that she's his mother,
Jennifer replied, stroking his fluffy head. From what she'd heard, the mystery woman still couldn't recollect her name, where she'd come from, or anything that had happened before her accident. So the news that she had somehow given birth to a baby son while she was unconscious had come as a huge shock to her. Jennifer wasn't surprised it was taking her a while to get used to the idea that she was the mother of a newborn.
All the same, you'd think she'd want to see him, wouldn't you? If only out of curiosity. Why should she if she doesn't believe he's hers? Well, perhaps if she saw him, she might have some kind of, well, I don't know, motherly instinct.
Jennifer smiled down at the baby, who stared back up at her with unfocused eyes. One of his hands came free of his shawl. It was like a tiny pink starfish, hardly bigger than her thumb.
I don't think it works like that, O'Hara.
Katie shook her head.
It's so sad. What'll happen to him if she doesn't accept him?
I don't know. I suppose if they can't find the father, they'll put him up for adoption. That'd be such a shame, wouldn't it? The little angel deserves to grow up in a real family.
Jennifer stroked his tiny palm with the tip of her finger. His fingers immediately closed around hers, grasping her with surprising strength. A lump of emotion rose in her throat.
Yes,
she replied.
Yes, he does.
Chapter 8. The following day, up on female surgical, Millie and the mystery woman were talking about anything and everything except the baby. Sister Judd had warned them not to mention him for a while.
The consultant believes she's been through enough emotional trauma over the past couple of days, and it's not a good idea to tax her any further,
she advised, in her whispering voice, having gathered her nurses around her desk the previous morning.
We need to be gentle with her, but that doesn't mean we can't try to coax her memory in other ways. Try to talk to her as much as possible. Ask her questions. Perhaps something might trigger a memory.
Which was why, as Millie washed the woman, she was chattering about her own forthcoming wedding.
We can't get married until after I qualify, so the date is set for straight after my state finals next October,
she said, as she sponged her down.
That's if Seb, my fiancé, is back in England by then. He's a journalist, you see, a foreign correspondent based in Berlin,
she added proudly. The woman didn't react as she carefully soaped her limbs. Millie tried again.
What about your husband?
She asked. The woman's mouth was an obstinate line.
What husband? I don't have a husband.
Well, you have a wedding ring.
The woman looked down at it detached.
I don't remember anything about him,
she said flatly. Millie thought about it for a moment.
Aren't you curious, though?
Of course I'm curious,
the woman snapped.
Do you think I like not knowing who I am or where I come from?
I suppose not.
Millie bit her lip.
But You might be able to find him if you could remember something. A name or what he looks like.
Don't you think I'm trying?
The woman cut her off angrily.
Every morning I wake up hoping it will all come back to me. I lie here, hour after hour, thinking of names and faces, hoping something will fit, but it never does.
She dashed away a tear with a soapy hand.
I don't even remember that trolley bus hitting me, let alone what I was doing on the Mile End Road.
She stopped, catching Millie's look.
What? What are you staring at?
How did you know you were on the Mile End Road?
Millie asked. The woman frowned.
I don't know, do I? One of you lot must have said something.
Millie shook her head.
None of us know where the accident happened.
Then the police must have told me.
She thought for a moment.
Yes, when the policeman came to see me yesterday morning, I'm sure he mentioned it. How else would I know something like that?
How indeed?
Millie thought, as she fetched a warm towel from the radiator. As she helped dry her down, the woman said,
How's the baby?
Millie hesitated.
I thought you didn't remember being pregnant.
I don't, but you lot say I was, and all I seem to hear is whispering about him, and then there's this.
She put her hand over her operation scar, under its thick layer of dressing.
I'm just curious, that's all.
Oh, he's a little pet, so I'm told. All the nurses adore him, they've called him Gabriel.
Gabriel?
Because he arrived at Christmas, and he's an angel.
Millie grinned.
But he's not feeling particularly angelic at the moment, from what I hear. He's had a touch of colic.
The woman stopped in the middle of drying herself, her dark brows drawing together in a frown.
Colic? What's that? Is it serious?
Not really. Just a few little pains, that's all. The nurses are looking after him, so I'm sure he'll soon get over it.
Millie sent her a knowing smile.
You seem very concerned.
The woman looked away.
I don't like to think of any kiddie in pain.
Are you sure you wouldn't like to go down and take a quick peep at him?
She offered.
The consultant said you're well enough to be up and about, and I could fetch a wheelchair for you.
No,
the woman insisted, her mask back in place.
I've already said I don't remember him. He means nothing to me.
Chapter 9. By that evening, baby Gabriel's colic had begun to settle, but he was still fretful, howling in his cot after his feed, his little knees drawn up in pain.
Sister Parry says we should leave him if he cries,
the worried student told Violet Tanner, the night sister, when she did her rounds.
She says babies get spoiled if they're picked up too often.
Violet held on to her temper. Sister Parry was an excellent, conscientious nurse who cared deeply for the children in her own way, but she had no motherly instincts at all.
Sister Parry is not in charge of this ward during the night. I am, she stated firmly, and I want you to pick that baby up and comfort him until he goes to sleep. If you don't, he will only scream the place down and wake up all the other children, and we don't want that, do we?
No, sister, thank you, sister.
The student bobbed her head.
If he doesn't settle, try massaging his stomach for a while. Or call me and we'll try some weak peppermint water. That may help him.
Yes, sister.
As soon as the young girl picked the baby out of his cot, his crying subsided. No doubt Sister Parry would say that proved how spoiled he was, but to Violet it just meant he was more comfortable in a different position. Either way, at least he might go to sleep and give the poor, exhausted student some rest too. She was leaving the ward when she saw a hunched shadow moving slowly at the far end of the corridor ahead of her.
Hello, who's there?
She lifted her torch, and its beam trapped a woman, barefoot and cowering, in a hospital nightgown at the foot of the stairs. Violet recognized her at once. It was the mystery woman from Judd Ward.
Gracious, what are you doing out of bed? She called out.
I got lost on my way to the toilet.
You should have called the night nurse to help you.
Violet approached her. She was hunched over, her hands across her abdomen, face twisted in pain. How she'd made it down two flights of stairs after such a major operation, she didn't know. She must have been very determined to get where she was going, Violet thought. And then it dawned on her.
Were you looking for the nursery, by any chance?
No,
the woman replied too quickly.
I told you I wanted the toilet.
There are two toilets on Judd Ward. You must have walked right past them. Here, let me help you.
Violet steered her towards the stairs and sat her down.
You wait there where I find a porter to bring a wheelchair for you. You can't possibly walk back to the ward in your condition.
I'm fine,
the woman said through gritted teeth. Her face was pale in the torchlight.
Even so, I shall summon a porter.
Violet hesitated.
But we can go to the nursery first, if you'd prefer.
The woman stared at the ground, her face stubborn.
No,
she muttered. The porter arrived shortly afterwards and helped her into a wheelchair.
They headed back up to female surgical, where the terrified student was wandering the passageway looking for her. Violet smiled.
You see? You give the nurses quite a fright when you wander off in the middle of the night.
I'll bear that in mind,
the woman grunted. As she watched her heading off towards the ward doors, accompanied by the student, Violet suddenly called out to her,
By the way.
The woman turned around slowly.
What?
Gabriel's colic isn't too serious. Just a bit uncomfortable for the poor lamb, that's all. In case you were wondering.
The woman didn't answer. But in the darkness, Violet thought she saw the slightest nod of her head. Chapter 10. Visiting day on the male orthopaedic ward was usually a happy time. But Dora noticed that one of the patients was looking miserable as Sister Blake opened the ward doors and the visitors began to file in two by two. She watched him, his eyes fixed expectantly on the doors, only to see his face fall as the last of the visitors arrived and made their way to the other beds. She made him a cup of tea to cheer him up.
Here you are, Mr. Shimwell, nice and strong the way you like it.
Thanks, nurse.
But he didn't give her his usual smile, or even look up as she placed the cup down on his bedside locker. She frowned at him, concerned.
Everything all right, Mr. Shimwell?
Not really.
His gaze strayed past her to the double doors.
I thought my missus might come today, and there's no sign of her.
Dora searched for something reassuring to say, but the words deserted her. There had been no sign of Mr. Shimwell's wife since he was brought in 4 days earlier. He was one of the passengers injured on the trolley bus on Christmas Eve. That night they'd been besieged on the ward by worried relatives, anxious for news of their loved ones. But no one seemed to be worried about poor Mr. Shinwell and his fractured ankle. It was a shame, she thought. He was such a lovely man. Never any trouble and so grateful for all the attention the nurses gave him, even though they assured him a dozen times a day that they were only doing their job.
Oh, there must be some explanation, I'm sure,
she said briskly as she plumped up his pillows. But Mr. Shinwell didn't look convinced.
I think she's left me, he said.
Dora stared down at him, the pillow still in her hands.
Surely not.
I've seen it coming for a while.
He ran his hand through his thinning dark hair.
We've been having a few troubles, you see. Maya always said I put my business before her. And maybe I did. But I only did it for her,
he added, his dark brown eyes pleading for understanding.
We arrived here with nothing. And I've been doing my best to build up my furniture-making business. I want to give her a good life, you see. The kind of life she's always wanted.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, surely.
Dora said.
Except I could never seem to give her what she wanted. That's why she's left me.
He looked downcast, his heavy-lidded eyes full of sadness.
I've lost her forever, I know I have. She's gone off and found someone who can make her happy.
I'm sorry,
Dora murmured. Mr. Shinwell looked up at her, suddenly hopeful.
Will you do something for me, nurse?
He pleaded.
Go round to my house. See if she really has gone.
Dora shook her head.
I don't think I should get involved, Mrs. Shimwell. That's a job for the police.
He shook his head impatiently.
They've already been round. Reckon they couldn't get an answer when they knocked. But I need to know for sure, you see. I need to know if my Maya has really left me.
He reached into his locker drawer and pulled out a set of keys.
Here. You can let yourself in. It's number 7 Pikestaff Street, near Stepney Green.
He tried to give her the keys, but Dora tucked her hands behind her back.
I really can't, Mr. Shimwell. I'll get into terrible trouble if anyone found out.
I won't. Please, nurse,
he begged.
I wouldn't ask if I wasn't desperate.
Dora hesitated. She knew it was against the rules, but Mr. Shinwell was obviously going mad with worry. He wasn't eating or sleeping, and even though his injuries weren't too serious, he didn't seem to be recovering as quickly as he should. It was as if he'd lost the will to get better. Perhaps if he knew his wife was waiting for him at home, it might encourage him. And even if she wasn't, at least his mind might be at rest. She checked up and down the ward. Luckily, Sister Blake was busy talking to a group of junior students around the ward table, so she couldn't see her.
All right, give me the keys,
she murmured in a low voice, holding out her hand.
Thanks, nurse.
He handed them to her, and Dora slipped them into her pocket.
I'm grateful to you, I really am.
I only hope I don't live to regret it,
Dora said. Chapter 11.
I wish you nurses would pick up your post more often,
the head porter, Mr. Hopkins, grumbled.
This has been waiting for you for 2 days now. If this continues, I will have to talk to Matron about it.
He pulled himself up to his full 5'6" and puffed out his chest.
I can't have things cluttering up my cubbyholes.
But Jennifer Ryan wasn't listening. She was too busy staring at the parcel,
wrapped in flowery paper and topped off with a flamboyant bow that Mr. Hopkins had just set before her in the hatch of the porter's lodge.
"There's a letter with it."
Mr. Hopkins slapped a plain white envelope on top of the parcel.
"Most insistent you should read it, he was. As if it's any of my business what you nurses do with your post. As long as you won't leave it here."
His neatly trimmed moustache bristled. Given the chance, Jennifer would have abandoned the parcel and walked away. But with Mr. Hopkins's steely gaze on her, she had no choice but to carry the box back to her room. Even then, she had no intention of opening it. Just because her father had delivered it, that didn't mean she had to take any notice. His persistence irritated her. Why couldn't he respect her wish to be left alone? But in the end, her curiosity got the better of her. Sitting on her bed, leaving the parcel on the floor by her feet, she tore open the letter and read it.
"Dear Jenny,"
it said, in her father's neat, precise handwriting,
"I tried to give this to you on Christmas Day, but you wouldn't take it. However, I feel it's very important you have it, so I'm leaving it here for you. You asked for the truth, and so I'm giving it to you. Inside this parcel is a box containing everything your mother and I ever knew about your birth. It doesn't amount to a great deal. Just your birth certificate and a couple of photographs taken when you were a baby, presumably with your mother. We never met her, but the adoption agency said she was a respectable young woman. Your mother and I prayed for her happiness every day, and never stopped thanking her for the wonderful child she had given us. As I've said, it may not be much, but it may be enough for you to start looking for your real parents if that's what you want. Jenny, I'm so sorry you feel we let you down and lied to you. Perhaps we should have told you, but in our defense, all I can say is that from the moment we brought you into our home, we genuinely felt you were our baby. There was never any question in our mind that we didn't love you as our own, and we always have. What you do next is your decision. You are a wonderful, wise young woman, and I dare say you will do what is best. But whatever happens, I want you to know that I will always love you, and I will always, always think of you as my dearest daughter. I wish you every happiness, my darling. From your loving father, Geoffrey Ryan."
It was seeing his name, written in neat cursive script, that lanced her heart with pain. By the end of the letter she could hardly make out the words through a blur of hot tears. She heard footsteps approaching down the passageway towards her room, and quickly tried to wipe her eyes, just as Helen walked in. It was midday, and she must have just woken up after her night duty. She came in bleary-eyed, still half asleep, but she snapped awake as soon as she saw the box.
"What's that?" "A present. From my father. Aren't you going to open it?"
Jennifer shook her head.
"I already know what's in it."
Helen frowned.
"You don't seem very excited. Is it something awful?" "I don't know."
Jennifer sighed. She looked up at Helen. She had been so preoccupied with her own misery, she hadn't really given the other girl a fair chance since she'd moved in. But Helen wasn't like the other nurses, always scrabbling around for the latest gossip they could pass around the wards. Her face was so full of sympathy and kindness. Jennifer knew she could trust her. Besides, she had to share her thoughts with someone. They'd been buzzing around inside her head like angry flies for so long, they were in danger of sending her mad if she didn't let them out soon.
"If I tell you something, can you promise to keep it a secret?" she said.
Helen frowned.
"Well, that depends what it is," she replied. "If keeping your secret means hurting someone else or putting them in danger, then I can't promise anything."
Jennifer nodded. At least she was honest about it.
"It's nothing like that," she said. "But it's personal."
Helen slipped off her shoes and sat down on her bed, tucking her feet under her.
"Then tell me,"
she said. Jennifer told her. She explained everything. From that dreadful moment at her mother's funeral, when a well-meaning distant cousin had accidentally let slip the shocking revelation, to her latest argument with her father. All the while, Helen said nothing. She listened intently, her head cocked to one side, her dark eyes thoughtful. Finally, Jennifer finished her story.
"Well?"
she said. Helen remained silent for a moment, taking it all in. Then she looked at the parcel.
"What are you going to do about that?"
she asked. They stared at the box, sitting like a malevolent presence between them.
"I don't know,"
Jennifer replied with a sigh.
"But it's what you want, isn't it? To find out the truth?" "I suppose so." "Well, then I'm surprised you haven't ripped it open by now to see what's inside. I probably should."
Jennifer eyed the box, with its silly silk bow on top.
She had the dreadful feeling that once she opened the parcel, that would be it. There would be no going back. She pushed the parcel under her bed with her foot until it was out of sight.
"I'll think about it later," she said.
Chapter 12. Pikestaff Street was a narrow, cobbled alley close to Stepney Green Station. On one side was a row of terraced houses, on the other a high brick wall with a warren of factories, workshops, and warehouses beyond. It teemed with sound and life. Dogs barking, babies crying, and gangs of children chasing each other noisily in the street, heedless of the cold December weather. The area might be scruffy, but as Dora expected, each house was well kept, with a red polished doorstep, shining windows, and gleaming brasswork on the door. Number 7 was the best kept of all. Dora knocked on the japanned front door and waited. There was no answer. She went to the window and tried to peer in through the net curtains.
"You won't find anyone at home."
She looked round. Next door a woman stood on the doorstep, arms folded across the bosom of her pinny. Her hair was caught up in a scarf, and a cigarette hung slackly from her lips.
"Not been sight nor sound of them ever since Christmas Eve. If you ask me, they've done a flick, and they've left their bleeding cat behind. I've been having to feed the poor little sod scraps just to stop it yowling all night."
She pulled a face.
"I've been a right good neighbour, considering I hardly know 'em."
"They haven't lived here long, then?"
"Oh, no, they've been here years. But they keep themselves to themselves, don't see fit to mix with the rest of us. He's always out working, and as for her, well, she walks around with her nose in the air like she's too good for everyone. Foreigners."
She gave Dora a knowing nod, as if that explained everything.
"You from the corporation?"
she asked, as Dora took out the key Mr. Shinwell had given her.
"No."
"Friend of theirs, then?"
"Not exactly."
"I thought not. They don't have many friends."
Dora managed to get the door open, and the woman went to follow her.
"So how come you've got a..."
Dora closed the door on her before she had a chance to finish her question. Poor Mr. Shinwell had enough on his plate without nosy neighbours gossiping about his problems. The house smelled of polish and pine. The Shinwells didn't have much to their name. Their furniture was old, but well kept and lovingly polished. Paper chains hung limply across the tiled fireplace in the cosy kitchen, and a small, stiff-looking Christmas tree stood in the corner. As Dora brushed past it towards the scullery, its branches shivered and let loose a rain of dried-out pine needles. Dora winced. Sweeping them up would be a devil of a job for someone.
"Sorry, Mrs. Shinwell,"
she murmured, as she pushed aside the curtain that separated the main room from the scullery. Once again, there was nothing out of place. The sink and draining board were empty, any crockery put neatly away in the tiny dresser. Dora felt the dishcloth hanging over the tap. It was dry and stiff, as if it hadn't been used in days. She frowned. Someone as house-proud as Mrs. Shinwell obviously was would have been wiping up several times a day. Her heart sinking, she went upstairs to the bedroom. She had expected to find a dramatic scene waiting for her. The wardrobe doors flung open, and everything gone, perhaps. But as she tentatively opened the doors of the battered mahogany cupboard, there were all Mrs. Shinwell's dresses and skirts, neatly lined up. Dora stood in the middle of the room and looked around, her hands on her hips. It was as if the couple had been simply spirited away. Well, at least she could go back to the Nightingale and tell Mr. Shinwell that his wife hadn't left him. But then he was bound to ask where she was. How could she tell him his missus had disappeared into thin air?
"Where are you, Mrs. Shinwell?"
She spoke the words aloud into the empty room, and immediately felt daft. What did she expect? Mrs. Shinwell to come out from under the bed and say she'd been dusting? She heard the clock downstairs chiming the hour, and realized she should be getting back to the hospital. She was due back on duty at 5, and nice though Sister Blake was, she wouldn't take kindly to one of her nurses strolling in late. She was about to leave when she spotted the photograph on the bedside table. It was a framed picture of the couple on their wedding day. She immediately recognized Mr. Shinwell, bursting with pride in his best suit. But there was something familiar about the plump, dark-haired bride clinging to his arm, too. Dora stared at the photograph and remembered Millie talking about their mystery patient, small, dark-haired, from Eastern Europe. It couldn't be, could it? Chapter 13.
"So when can I leave?"
Millie suppressed a sigh. The woman had been asking the same question every day since she'd woken up.
"You have to wait and see what the consultant says,"
she replied patiently, tucking her bedclothes in around her.
"You had a serious operation a few days ago. These things take time."
"But I haven't got time,"
the woman snapped.
"I mean, I'm feeling perfectly well,"
she added.
Well, we'll have to wait until the consultant does his rounds later.
Millie straightened up.
I can't imagine he'll allow you to be discharged until your stitches come out, and that'll be several days yet. I should think you'll be in here for at least another fortnight.
A fortnight?
The woman looked aghast. Millie nodded.
There's a risk of infection if you try to get up and about too early. Besides, I can't think why you're in such a hurry to leave. We still don't know anything about you, do we? I mean, where will you go when you're discharged?
I don't know, do I?
The woman scowled at her.
I just don't like hospitals, that's all.
I know where you'll go.
They both turned. As usual, Millie hadn't heard Sister Judd's whispering approach until she was standing at the foot of the woman's bed.
I have a wonderful surprise for you, she said. We know who you are.
Millie glanced at the woman. Her sallow face had turned ashen.
Your name is Maya Shinwell. You're 32 years old, and you live in Stepney Green, Sister Judd went on.
The woman didn't respond. It was as if all the life had drained out of her. It must be shock, Millie decided.
And I have even better news, Sister Judd said. We found your husband.
I don't understand.
When the woman finally found her voice, she was whispering even more quietly than Sister Judd.
He's in this very hospital. Can you imagine that? It turns out he was injured in the same trolley bus accident as you. Now, what do you think are the chances of that?
Sister Judd shook her head, marveling at the coincidence.
It was just a fractured ankle, nothing too serious. Nothing for you to worry about. I expect we can arrange for him to come up and visit you shortly.
No!
The woman spoke so sharply, Millie and Sister Judd were both startled.
No, I don't want to see him.
But surely...
You don't understand. I don't remember him. He could be anyone. He could be a stranger making up stories about me.
Why would anyone do such a thing?
I don't know. I don't know anything about him.
She flung back the bedclothes and started to struggle out of bed.
I've got to go. I don't want to stay here.
Calm down, please.
Sister Judd looked startled.
Get back into bed. You don't have to meet your husband yet, not if you don't want to.
She turned her attention to Millie.
Make the patient comfortable again, if you please, Nurse Benedict. I'll fetch her some brandy to calm her down. I dare say this has all been rather a shock for her.
Sister looked as if it had all been a shock for her, too, as she scuttled off down the ward. Millie helped the woman back into bed and pulled the bedclothes up around her.
I don't want to see him,
she was muttering under her breath over and over again.
You can't make me see him, you can't. I don't know him, I don't remember him.
Her breathing was shallow, her chest rising and falling as she worked herself into a panic. Millie tried to press her back against the pillows, but her body was rigid.
Please, you'll make yourself ill.
I don't remember him, I don't remember him.
Mrs. Shinwell.
What?
The woman looked at her sharply.
Try to calm down, please. Sister will be back shortly with the brandy. Ah, here she comes now.
She stepped back from the bed and watched as Sister Judd put the glass into the woman's shaking hand. She was in a state of shock. There was no doubt about that. But from the way she responded when Millie spoke her name, there was also no doubt in Millie's mind that she remembered more than she was letting on. Chapter 14. Meanwhile, over on Male Orthopaedic, Dora and Sister Blake were breaking the news to Alex Shinwell that his wife had stepped in front of the very same trolley bus that had injured him. He was so horrified, Dora really felt for him. She was glad it was Sister Blake and not her who had to break the news.
Oh my God! My poor Maya, is she badly hurt?
It could have been a lot worse,
Sister Blake admitted frankly. There are no broken bones, but she has sustained an injury to the head that has caused memory loss.
Memory loss?
Mr. Shinwell frowned. The consultant has every reason to believe that her loss is temporary, but at the moment she appears to remember nothing at all.
Nothing?
His face fell.
Not even me?
I'm afraid not, Mrs. Shinwell. She can't even remember her own name at the moment. Her life is a complete blank up to the moment she woke up in hospital.
Poor Maya!
He shook his head, taking it in.
That explains why she didn't come looking for me, doesn't it?
He looked at Dora, his dark eyes shining with hope.
And I thought she'd left me.
He seized Dora's hands.
Oh, nurse, I'm so grateful to you. If you hadn't got round to our house as I'd asked...
Ahem!
Sister Blake interrupted him with a polite cough. I think the least said about Nurse Doyle's involvement in this matter, the better. She sent Dora a stern look.
But at least this has ended well. So that's something.
Dora tried to hide her smile. She knew Sister Blake was a good sport. She was unlikely to report her to Matron. And besides, if it hadn't been for her, the mystery of the Shinwells might never have been cleared up.
I must go to her, Mr. Shinwell said. I need to see her.
I'm afraid that won't be possible for a while, Mr. Shinwell. Dora could see Sister Blake choosing her words carefully. Mrs. Shinwell is a little indisposed at present.
What? But you said...
She's in good health, but she's taking a little time to adjust to her situation, Sister Blake said. I'm sure Sister Judd will let us know when she's ready for visitors.
If you say so.
Dora could see Mr. Shinwell was doing his best to hide his disappointment. But I have some more good news for you, Sister Blake went on. Mr. Shinwell looked up at her.
More good news?
Sister Blake glanced at Dora. You have a son, Mr. Shinwell. There was a long pause. Mr. Shinwell stared blankly at Sister Blake, then at Dora.
But that can't be possible.
I know she wasn't due to give birth for at least another month, but your wife went into early labour after her accident. The baby was born by emergency caesarean on Christmas Eve. A fine, healthy boy. The nurses on the children's ward have quite taken him to their heart, so I understand. She smiled. Perhaps you'd like to visit your son, Mrs. Shinwell. He didn't react for a moment. His face was rigid like a mask.
You don't understand, he said. It can't be possible because my wife wasn't pregnant.
He looked up at them.
I think you must have got the wrong woman.
Chapter 15. On the afternoon of New Year's Eve, Helen met Millie and Dora in the cafe on the corner and listened in shocked fascination as they filled her in on the latest gossip on the wards.
Oh, Mr. Shinwell's adamant his wife wasn't pregnant the last time he saw her, Dora explained. And our Mrs. Shinwell is just as adamant that she was never married,
Millie joined in. Helen paused to smile at the waitress, and she put their tea things on the table.
Are you sure you've got the right people? According to their wedding photograph, Dora said. And if you ask me, I think Mrs. Shinwell remembers more than she's letting on, Millie added. It's a rum do,
Dora said, helping herself to a biscuit from the assortment on a plate in front of them.
And meanwhile, there's poor little Gabriel, the child no one seems to want, Millie sighed. What do you think'll happen to him?
Dora shrugged.
I suppose if no one claims him, he'll have to be put up for adoption. Surely not.
Millie's pretty face crumpled in concern.
That's such a shame for the poor little thing.
Oh, at least he'll have half a chance of finding parents who'll love him.
Yes, but it's not the same as knowing your own parents, is it?
Not according to Jennifer Ryan, Helen thought, as she stirred her tea. Helen couldn't understand why it was so important to her to find the woman who'd given birth to her, when the Ryans were the ones who'd brought her up and shaped her life. Perhaps she would feel differently about it if she were in Jennifer's shoes, Helen thought. It must be awful to grow up believing one thing, only to find suddenly that everyone has conspired to lie to you. Helen thought about the box that still sat under the bed, untouched for 2 days.
What do you want to do with it?
Helen had asked the day before.
I don't know, do I? I haven't had a chance to think about it.
Jennifer had snapped back, although from her irritable manner, Helen guessed she had thought about little else. She came back to the present to find Millie chattering about her plans for that evening.
As soon as I come off duty at 9, I'm meeting Seb, and we're heading off to the Savoy to celebrate the New Year,
she was telling Dora.
I couldn't even think about celebrating.
Dora stifled a yawn with the back of her hand.
I'm so tired I could go to bed and sleep right through to February. How about you, Dawson? With any luck, I'll sleep right through it too, as long as there's no last-minute emergencies in theatre.
Helen toyed with her teaspoon.
I must say, I'll be very glad to see the back of this year, she sighed.
She caught the others' sympathetic looks and felt guilty. She tried not to talk about Charlie too often, but sometimes she just couldn't help it. Losing him was the worst pain she had ever endured, and she couldn't imagine a time when she didn't cry herself to sleep or wake up in the morning missing him. Millie reached across the table and touched her hand.
Next year will be better, she said,
her pretty face earnest. Helen smiled sadly.
I hope so.
But she couldn't believe it would be. Next year, 1937, she would have to face the anniversary of losing Charlie. She was already dreading it. Chapter 16. At 4:30, Dora and Millie had to leave Helen and hurry back on duty.
She looked so sad, didn't she?
Millie said, as they headed back to the hospital, their heads down against the bitter winter weather.
I'm not surprised,
Dora replied, her words carried away on the wind that whipped around them.
Must be the worst thing in the world to go through what she has. I know,
Millie shuddered, remembering the time she thought she might lose Seb when he was posted to Spain to cover the Civil War.
I wish there was something we could do to help her. She just needs time,
Dora said wisely. Then looking at her watch, she added,
Speaking of which, we're due back in 10 minutes.
They broke into a run, remembering to slow down to a rapid heel toe walk as they got through the big iron gates of the hospital. It was a strict rule that nurses were not allowed to run, except in case of fire or hemorrhages. They raced back to the nurses' home, deftly escaping the attention of the home sister, changed into their uniforms, then hurried back to the main ward block. Millie reached Judd Ward with seconds to spare, breathless and still trying to tuck her blonde curls under her cap, but she needn't have bothered, since no one seemed to notice her arrival. The place was in an uproar, with nurses scuttling around, searching under beds, in cupboards and bathrooms.
What's happened?
She asked a probationer, who appeared from the sluice.
It's Mrs. Shinwell,
the pro replied breathlessly.
She's run away.
Run away? Where?
Well, if we knew that, we wouldn't be looking,
she heard the pro mutter, just as Sister Judd hurried up to her.
Benedict, I want you to go down to the porter's lodge and alert Mr. Hopkins to look out for Mrs. Shinwell, she whispered. Tell him we've searched the ward, and now I want all the porters searching the building. She really can't have got far in her condition. But she's taken her clothes with her, so she'll be trying to get out through the gates, I expect.
Yes, sister.
Sister Judd shook her head.
She must be very determined to leave, since she must be in a great deal of pain.
When Millie reached the porter's lodge, she was surprised to see Dora already standing in the doorway.
Hello? What are you doing here?
Dora greeted her.
I've got to see Mr. Hopkins urgently. One of our patients has disappeared.
Dora's green eyes widened.
Wouldn't be Mrs. Shinwell by any chance, would it? How did you know? Because Mr. Shinwell's down a bunk too.
Chapter 17. Sister Parry was spending a week visiting her family in the West Country, so Jennifer Ryan was in charge of the children's ward on New Year's Eve. At 5 o'clock she was in the milk kitchen supervising the student making up the feeds, when a pro appeared in the doorway white-faced.
Please, staff, there's a strange man on the ward, she whispered. Well, tell him to go away. I've tried, staff. He says he won't leave until he sees his son, and he's wearing a hospital gown, she added. A hospital? Are you quite sure, right? Yes, staff. Well, I suppose I'd better come and see for myself.
Jennifer dried her hands and followed the pro out onto the ward. A man stood in the doorway, stocky, dark and heavy-featured, and just as the pro had said, he was dressed in a hospital gown and leaning on a stick. Jennifer composed herself and approached him.
Yes,
she said, in her best imitation of Sister Parry's imperious tone.
What can I do for you?
I've come to see my son.
Jennifer's gaze dropped to his bare legs, one foot encased in plaster, sticking out from the bottom of his white gown.
Visiting time was Christmas Eve, she advised. The next one isn't until a week today.
The man adjusted his weight on his stick.
I'm sorry to be a trouble, nurse, but I'm not leaving until I see my Gabriel.
Gabriel?
Jennifer stared at him.
You're Gabriel's father?
So they tell me.
Jennifer caught the pro's startled look and knew exactly what she was thinking.
But that's not...
she started to say, then stopped herself.
What is it, nurse?
The man frowned.
Is it my son? Is there something wrong?
Jennifer hesitated. Yes, there was definitely something wrong. But she wasn't going to be the one to explain it to this man. Better that he found out the truth for himself.
You'd better come with me,
she said. Chapter 18.
Really, I don't know what it is with you nurses,
Mr. Hopkins tutted.
I know you're forever losing things, but it comes to something when you start losing patience.
Millie did her best to hide her impatience as the head porter droned on. She was just about to excuse herself from his lecture when she suddenly spotted a figure hunched against one of the plane trees opposite the lodge.
It's all right, Mr. Hopkins. I think I found her.
She left him staring open-mouthed and dashed across the drive. It wasn't difficult to catch Mrs. Shinwell. She could barely shuffle along, her body bent double.
Where do you think you're going?
Millie asked, catching hold of her arm.
Don't try to stop me, nurse. I've got to go.
Tears ran down Mrs. Shinwell's cheeks, but her determined gaze was fixed on the gates ahead of her.
You can't leave, Mrs. Shinwell. You haven't had your stitches out yet.
I don't care.
But you could get a serious infection, not to mention all the pain you must be in.
I told you I don't care. All the pain in the world doesn't compare to the pain I've caused the people I love.
She stopped speaking abruptly. Millie stared at her.
I was right. You do remember.
Mrs. Shinwell hung her head.
I remember all right,
she mumbled.
I only wish I didn't.
Is that why you pretended you'd lost your memory?
I just wanted time to think, decide what to do next.
And have you decided?
Mrs. Shinwell lifted her dark gaze to Millie's.
Oh, yes, she said. I'm going to do what I set out to do on Christmas Eve and walk away from it all. I only wish I'd stepped off that curb a second earlier. Then I wouldn't be in this terrible mess.
Millie gasped.
You can't mean that.
What do you know about it? You don't know what I've done. I've ruined everything. They'll all be better off without me.
She burst into noisy tears. Millie reached into her apron pocket for a handkerchief and handed it to her.
Why don't you tell me everything?
She suggested.
It might make you feel better.
I doubt it.
Mrs. Shinwell blew her nose noisily.
I doubt if anything could make me feel better. Not after what I've done. I've been so wicked.
She started to cry again. Millie patted her arm.
It can't do any harm, though, can it? Go on. Tell me what's happened. Right from the very beginning.
Chapter 19.
It was all my fault,
Maya Shinwell explained, as she and Millie sat on the bench in the middle of the courtyard. Millie had already sent word with Mr. Hopkins to let Sister Judd know that Mrs. Shinwell had been found safe and sound.
I was weak and selfish, and I ruined everything.
Millie held on to her hand and said nothing. It was hard to piece together Mrs. Shinwell's story, coming in short snatches between prolonged bouts of sobbing. From what she could gather, Mr. and Mrs. Shinwell had had several happy years of marriage together. But then it had all started to go wrong.
We'd been trying for a baby for so long, she explained. We kept telling each other it didn't matter, that God would be good to us in time. But as time went on and nothing happened, it got harder and harder to pretend.
She dabbed her face with Millie's handkerchief, now crumpled in her fist.
I know Alex was disappointed that we couldn't have a child,
she sniffed.
I could feel him growing more distant every day. He worked all hours, sometimes all night. He said he had to work, to build up the business. But I knew it was just an excuse so he didn't have to come back home to a silent house with only me to greet him. I don't know if he blamed me or if he blamed himself, but all I really wanted was for him to put his arms around me, tell me he still loved me. I was so lonely, so unbearably lonely.
Millie stroked the woman's blunt, stubby fingers.
So, you found someone else?
She guessed.
A sailor from Stockholm.
Mrs. Shinwell's face was blank.
I didn't love him, not like I love Alex. But he was someone who noticed me, someone who cared or seemed to anyway. When I was with him, I could smile and pretend everything was all right again. But that's all I was doing, pretending. Our affair, if you can call it that, lasted all of a week before I called it off.
What happened to him?
Millie asked.
His ship went back to Sweden and I haven't heard from him since,
she said firmly.
And so he doesn't know about the baby?
She shook her head.
And I don't want him to either.
A tear plopped onto her hand and she rubbed it on her skirt.
I could hardly believe it when I found I was pregnant. It was as if God was punishing me, giving me my greatest wish and my worst nightmare at the same time. At first, I tried to pretend it wasn't happening. I thought if I didn't think about it, it might just go away. It wasn't the first time I'd been pregnant, you see, but all the others had been lost. So many babies gone.
Her voice trailed off.
But this little mite didn't go. He hung on, growing and growing inside me.
She put her hand over her belly, remembering.
Did your husband notice?
She shook her head.
I didn't really try to hide it from him. I think part of me wanted him to know, to get angry with me, but he didn't even notice. That shows you how far apart we'd grown.
Millie eyed her skeptically. She wouldn't have believed it was possible to hide a pregnancy like that. But with her stocky figure swaddled under layers of winter clothes, who could ever have guessed? Heaven knows. Even the experienced casualty nurses hadn't realized until she went into labor.
I suppose if there was no chance of you being pregnant, the idea wouldn't even have occurred to him,
she said.
It was more than that,
Maya Shinwell replied.
Alex was hardly ever at home, and when he was, he could hardly bring himself to look at me. We stopped sharing a bed months ago. He said he slept on the settee because he didn't want to disturb me when he came home late from work. But I knew it was because he was disappointed in me.
She took a deep, steadying breath.
I wanted to tell him, but I knew I couldn't. He didn't deserve that. He's a good man, a proud man, and it would have broken his heart.
I suppose you could have tried to pretend that the baby was his,
Millie ventured.
No.
Mrs. Shinwell looked shocked.
I could never have lied to Alex. I betrayed him once and that was hard enough to bear. To live the rest of my life deceiving him.
She shook her head.
It would have been too much.
So you tried to kill yourself?
Mrs. Shinwell looked up at Millie, her eyes shining with unshed tears.
"It was the only way out," she said. "I couldn't bear to face Alex to tell him the truth. I didn't want to hurt him, to bring shame on him."
She dissolved into shuddering sobs. Millie put her arm around her and tried to comfort her, but Mrs. Shinwell pulled away.
"No, I don't deserve it,"
she wept.
"I've been so selfish. I've hurt the man I love and tried to kill an innocent baby, the baby I've wanted for so many years. All I've ever longed for was a loving husband and a family, and now I've lost everything."
Millie stared at her, at a loss as how to console her. How could she ever comfort someone whose world had come crashing down around their ears?
"I should take you back to the ward," she said, rising to her feet.
Mrs. Shinwell looked up at her, her dark eyes swollen and rimmed with red.
"Before we go, do you think you could do something for me?"
she whispered.
"What is it, Mrs. Shinwell?"
"I want to see my son."
Chapter 20.
"He's beautiful,"
Alex Shinwell said. He sat on a chair beside the cot, his stick by his side, cuddling little Gabriel. For once, the baby was quiet, staring back up at him with unfocused eyes. Jennifer Ryan looked from Mr. Shinwell to the baby in his arms and back again. She hardly knew what to say. Was he really seeing what she was seeing? Yes, Gabriel was beautiful. He looked just like an angel, with his downy fair hair and blonde lashes framing eyes of the densest, deepest blue she had ever seen. There was no way on earth he could be the product of two dark-eyed, dark-haired parents. And yet this man didn't seem to see the truth staring back at him as he gazed adoringly down at the child.
"My son," he whispered, "do you know how long I've waited to hold you in my arms? There's so much I want to teach you. I'm going to help you to walk and to talk and to read and ride a bicycle. And when you're old enough, I'm going to teach you a trade, too. My trade, just as my father taught me. Do you think you'd like that, my boy? To learn how to use your hands and make fine furniture."
As if he knew what was being said to him, the baby flexed his tiny starfish hands, his pearly pink nails catching the light. Mr. Shinwell laughed and gently touched his palm, and the baby's fingers clenched reflexively round his.
"Of course. You might not want to spend your life up to your elbows in sawdust," Mr. Shinwell went on. "You can be anything you want, my son. You could be a doctor or wear a suit and tie and go to work in an office. You could even sweep the roads if that's what you want. As long as you're a good man and honest and happy, that's all I really want for you."
He looked up at Jennifer.
"That's all any father would want for his child, isn't it, nurse?"
"Why?"
But Jennifer was saved from replying as the doors flew open and one of the senior students, Nurse Benedict, came in pushing a dark-haired woman in a wheelchair. Jennifer caught the flash of recognition that passed between the woman and Mr. Shinwell.
"Alex,"
the woman whispered. For a moment no one spoke, and Jennifer could hear the air crackling with tension. Then Mr. Shinwell smiled and turned to show the baby to his wife.
"Look, Maya," he said, "we have a fine boy."
Jennifer and Millie exchanged glances. She could tell the other nurse was as startled as she was.
"Oh, Alex,"
the woman burst into tears.
"Alex, I'm so sorry."
Mr. Shinwell frowned. He seemed genuinely surprised.
"Why are you sorry, when you've given me such a beautiful son?"
"But
Maya, please."
Mr. Shinwell leaned forward and placed the baby carefully into her arms, then brushed the tears from her cheek.
"I don't need to know, all right? We have both made many mistakes, but it isn't important. All that's important is that God has granted us this wonderful gift. He has chosen me to be this baby's father, and how he came into this world doesn't matter."
Jennifer gruffly instructed the pro to keep an eye on the family reunion and walked away so no one would see the tears that pricked the backs of her eyes. Alex Shinwell was right. God had chosen him to be a good father to the baby, and nothing else mattered. Chapter 21. It was 7 o'clock in the morning on the first day of the new year, and Helen was coming wearily off night duty. Thank God there had been no surgical emergencies overnight, so she'd been able to snatch a few hours' sleep. She was surprised to find Ryan in their room, dressed in her uniform and fastening up her hair. She seemed remarkably chipper. Helen could have sworn she'd heard her humming to herself as she let herself into the room.
"Shouldn't you be on duty?"
she asked.
"Sister Perry's off, so I don't have to report until 8. Happy New Year, by the way."
Well, Happy New Year to you too. Helen's gaze fell to the box sitting on the rug. Well, you've decided to do something about it then?
Yes, I have, Jennifer replied through a mouthful of hairpins. And I want you to help me, she added.
Helen took a deep breath. She'd been dreading this.
Are you going to open it?
Jennifer fastened her last pin in place.
No, she said. I want you to help me take it down to the stokehole. I'm going to burn it.
Helen was shocked.
Are you sure? Once it's gone, you'll never know. It doesn't matter.
Jennifer's voice was firm.
It's not important. I thought you wanted to know who your real mother was. I know who she was, Jennifer said. She was the one who taught me to walk and to read and who picked me up when I fell down and kissed me and made everything better. That's what makes a real parent.
Helen nodded. She was glad Jennifer had finally come to realize that.
What changed your mind? She asked. Something someone said last night.
Jennifer shrugged.
So, will you help me with the box?
Certainly, Helen said. Down in the basement they stood together in front of the fiery mouth of the stokehole and watched it consume the box. Helen took a sideways glance at Jennifer. Were those real tears, or just caused by the acrid smoke billowing up the chimney?
I have to go, she excused herself tactfully. I need to go to bed. Of course.
When Jennifer turned to look at her, she was smiling again, all trace of her tears gone.
And I must go and telephone my father to wish him a happy new year.
You've been listening to A Child Is Born. It was written by Donna Douglas and read by Penelope Freeman. Other recordings by Donna Douglas include The Nightingale Girls, The Nightingale Sisters, and The Nightingale Nurses. This has been a Soundings Audiobooks presentation. If you've enjoyed this production, please write to us at Isis House, King's Drive, Whitley Bay, Tyne and Wear, NE26 2JT, or call 0191 253 4155, or visit our website www.isis-publishing.co.uk, and you will be sent a full list of our recordings.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program. Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.